That ain't worth my time to make the deed. Hell, I've had fellas come in here and want to buy 5 acres to put a cabin on. Can you imagine me going to the trouble of making out a deed and recording it for 75 cents? Crap.
You got a pencil and a piece of paper?
Zek asked. Sure. But I can tell you right off what a section is worth. It's $12.
I'd like the pencil anyway.
Zek figured for a moment, scratching his head along the way. He rechecked his figures and said, I want 60,000 acres.
Would you repeat that again?
The man said, staring with deeper interest at Zek.
60,000 acres.
Way I figure it, that's $9,000.
Well, you figure right, but listen, fella. We don't sell no land on credit. You've got to pay at least half down in the rest of the year.
I'll pay cash. I've got 9,000 in gold in my saddlebags. I'll bring it in now.
Zek went to the horse, came back, and threw the bags on the counter, creating a dull thump.
You can count it whenever you want. It's all there.
When can you get the deed ready?
For a chunk that size, it'll take me the best part of a day. And I'm ready to close up now for the night. My missus don't like to be alone with the young'uns after the sun goes down on account of all the riffraff we got around here. I can have everything for you first thing day after tomorrow. Does that suit you?
It does, if it's the best you can do. I hope to start back right away, but I'll kill the time somehow.
You're pretty good at counting katydids. If you ain't, I can loan you a fishing pole.
Don't worry about me. I'll be here day after tomorrow.
Here's a receipt for your money till it's counted and the deed is done,
the man said, handing Zek a slip of paper.
Come on over here and look at this map on the wall. It shows the whole general area, and you can point out where you'd rather have your land.
Zek studied the map for a moment. Then he put his finger to it and said, right in there, to the southeast, will do fine.
That area is the best of the lot,
the man said, marking it with a pin.
It ain't all swamp like some of it. I'll make sure the description is right for whenever you want it surveyed.
I'd appreciate that. The man took a ring of keys from a nail and said apologetically,
I'd ask you to stay the night at my place, but we don't have no spare room at all.
That's all right, I'll be fine.
Lordy me, he then said, popping his fingers. You shook me so with that land order, I plumb forgot to ask your name for the deed.
Zek McIvey. And I want 3 names on it. My wife and boy, too. I'll write it down for you.
The man accepted the printed names and said,
I'm Jasper Thurmond. It's been a pleasure doing business with you, Mr. McIvey.
You too, Zek responded, turning and leaving the store. He mounted Tiger, rode a short distance to an oak tree, dismounted and opened 1 tin of beef. As he ate hungrily, he wished he had brought Saul along just for company. After finishing the beef, he built a fire, spread a blanket, and fell into a tired sleep. At dawn, Zek ate the remaining canned beef and washed it down with water from his canteen. For a while he watched the rising sun burn the sky and tint flights of egrets heading out over the lake. Then he lost interest and mounted the horse. At first he rode south aimlessly, bored already with waiting for the deed, not at first aware he was heading in the direction of the Seminole village. Realization came slowly as he plodded onward, and then, he calculated, he was no more than 20 miles from the village. It would be a good day's outing and something to do while killing time, and also a chance to see Keith Tiger again. He had not thought of Tawanda when he planned the journey to the south shore of the lake, so close to her in the village. The purchase of land had been his only reason for coming. It had been too many years, too many happenings. And surely she would be married now with children of her own. Perhaps he would at least be able to speak to her briefly and learn her fate since their last meeting. This time he did not become lost and wander vainly as before, hoping to be discovered rather than discover. On his last trip he studied the landscape carefully, making mental notes in case he ever did return. And now, when he encountered changes from meadow to slough to swamp, he knew the direction he wanted to take. He reached the village at noon and found it to be the same as the last time he rode in, deserted except for 2 old women beneath a cooking chickie. No one challenged him as he approached. He tried to talk to one of the women, but she couldn't understand him, making signs toward the south of the clearing and chattering in a tongue unknown to him. Then he looked into all of the chickies and found them empty. He sat on a palm stump,
trying to decide what to do, to wait longer in hopes of someone returning soon, or leave now and reach the trading post before nightfall. Then he was startled, as a marsh tacky ridden by a young boy bounded out of the bush, dashed full gallop a yard from him, and disappeared into the woods. Several people then ran into the clearing as if chasing the horse, and before Zek regained his composure from the near miss by the dashing rider, Tawanda stopped suddenly in front of him, staring wide-eyed.
"Zek? Zek! Is it really you? I don't believe it."
"Yes, Tawanda, it's me," he replied, getting up. "I almost got run over by a horse just now. Who was that boy flying through here on the marsh tacky?"
"It was my son, Toby. The men are breaking horses at a corral in the swamp, and we've all been watching. Toby rides well, doesn't he?"
"I'll say," he answered, thinking of the words, "my son," knowing now she was married. "That horse barely touched the ground going by here. He rides like the wind. You must be real proud of him."
"Yes, I am."
He was still as surprised as she. And for the first time he looked at her, seeing that she was as he remembered, not yet touched by the years, still firm and youthful, with sparkling eyes and flowing black hair. For a moment more, neither of them spoke, as if waiting expectantly for the other to make the first move. And then Tawanda said,
"What are you doing here? I still can't believe it's really you."
"I had some business at a trading post on the south side of the lake, and just decided I'd try to find the village. This is the first time I've been back down this way since that time I came for the marsh tackies."
"It's been over 9 years, Zek. I think I can truthfully say that you don't visit very often. This time I had really given up hope of ever seeing you again. Come with me and we'll talk."
Zek followed her with trepidation, fearing what an Indian husband would do if he found them together, knowing there were surely people yet in the village who remembered seeing them together as lovers. They made no effort to hide it the last time he was here, but now he was not the only man in her life, and he wished to cause her no trouble by his presence. He regretted even making the trip to the village. They sat on a palm bench beside a chikki, Zek tapping his fingers nervously against the fibrous wood. She watched him for a moment, and then she said,
"Why are you so agitated, Zek? You are as nervous as a horse saddled for the first time. Is it because of something I have said?"
It embarrassed him that it was so obvious. He said, "Well, yes, it is, Tawanda. Your husband, where is he now? Will he come here soon?"
"So that's it," she said, smiling. "If that's what's bothering you, you can relax. I have no husband."
"No husband?" he questioned, puzzled. "But you said the boy's your son."
"He is. And yours, too."
"My son, too?" Zek's face drained white. "Tawanda, what are you saying?"
"Toby is our son. He is of both of us. We made him that night we spent together in the woods."
Zek was shocked, trying to grasp the full meaning of what she was saying. He finally said, "Why didn't you send word to me? Why didn't you let me know about this? I would have done something if I had known."
"That's why I sent no word. There was no need of it. You gave me what I wanted, and I didn't want to risk having it taken from me."
"I wouldn't have taken the boy, Tawanda. You should know better than that, but I would have done something, not just left you here alone with a baby."
"What would you have done? I have need of nothing but Toby."
Her calmness about the whole thing exasperated Zek. He then exclaimed, "Damn! All this time I've had a son down here and didn't know it. I could have come back to see both of you, Tawanda. I would have. I'm not an animal, but I didn't know."
"There's no need for you to become so excited," Tawanda said, taking his hand in hers. "We're not the first man and woman to make a baby. And I'm sure by now you have others.
A son. Only a son. His name is Saul. He's about the same age as Toby."
"That's good. Now you have two."
"Does Toby know?" Zek asked.
"Yes. Everyone here knows. At first, Toby was scorned as a half-breed. He was picked on by other boys because of his birth, and it was hard on him. But no one does this anymore. He's accepted now, and many say he will someday become the leader of our people. Everyone admires him. He's really a fine boy, Zek. And you can be proud of him, too.
This is going to take some time getting used to, Zek said. It's not like coming on a stray calf in the woods. Lord, I wish I'd known. What do you want me to do for him? I'll do anything you say.
Do for him? She questioned.
She thought for a moment, and then she said,
Yes, there is something you can do for him. You can promise me you'll never interfere in his life. Never. In no way. You must let him grow up here among his people, where he's happy and where he belongs. He will never be a part of your world, and you must know this. And you must never tell anyone in your world about Toby. Do you promise, Zek? This is all I ask of you.
If that's what you want, I promise. I'll never interfere. And I'll never tell anyone, but I wish I could do more.
When he comes back, you must meet him. After that, I'll fix food for the three of us. Would you like that?
Yes, I would. I would very much like to know Toby.
Now that this is all settled, aren't you going to do it?
Do it? Do what?
Kiss me. I haven't been kissed for 9 years, and you haven't touched me since you've been here.
Yes, I would like that, too. Very much.
He leaned over, put his arms around her, and kissed her gently. Then he repeated it. The second kiss was interrupted by a marsh tackie digging its hooves into the dirt and stopping just short of entering the chickie. Toby jumped down, ran to Tawanda, and said excitedly,
Did you see it, Mother? He's the best of the lot. I'll keep him for myself.
His features were all Seminole, except for Zek's deep brown eyes and the sandy tint to his hair.
Yes, I saw, Tawanda said, trying to calm him, but forget the horse for now. There's someone here you must know. This is your father, Zek McIvy.
The boy wheeled around quickly and stared at Zek, his eyes wide and boring into the stranger. Zek tried to smile but couldn't, and then he said,
Hello, Toby. It's good to know you. You're a fine-looking boy, and you ride as good as anyone I've ever seen.
You really think so?
Toby said hesitantly, unsure of himself and what to say or do.
Would you like to ride the horse?
Yes, but not now. I'd like to be with you first.
Tell me about yourself. What do you like to do best? Ride horses?
It was the same with me when I was your age.
I rode a marsh tackie, too, and his name was Ishmael. He was given to us a long time ago by Keith Tiger. He was killed, but we have two others like him. One of them is tied over there.
Toby glanced across the clearing at the horse. What's his name? He asked.
Tiger.
I named him after Keith Tiger.
You named him for a Seminole?
Yes, and I'm proud of it.
The Seminoles have always been our friends.
And I want to be your friend, too.
Will you go hunting with me?
I'll do anything you want me to do, and I have presents for you. Wait right here, and I'll get them.
Zek walked quickly to his horse and returned carrying the Winchester and a hunting knife with a 9-inch steel blade. He handed them to Toby and said, These are for you. Toby's eyes widened again as he turned the rifle over and over in his hands.
You mean this is for me? I can keep the rifle and the knife as my own?
They're yours now. And before I leave, I'll teach you to shoot the rifle. It's loaded, so be careful with it.
The awkwardness and the timidity suddenly vanished as Toby put the rifle down and ran to Zek, throwing his arms around him, seeking a relationship he hungered for. He said,
Thank you, Father. I've never had such presents.
Tawanda watched both of them, and when she heard the word father, she smiled. Toby turned to her and said,
Can I go now and show the rifle and the knife to Billy Bird? He won't believe what I have unless I show him.
Yes, go and show everyone you wish, but come back soon. We'll all eat together.
Zek smiled, too, as the boy bounded off, shouting,
Billy, Billy, come see. Come and see what my father brought me. Tawanda said, "You have made him very happy, Zack. He never expected to own such things. But wasn't it foolish to give away your rifle and face the return trip unarmed?"
Zack thought of how little the rifle now meant to him except as a killing tool, and how much it seemed to mean to Toby, the same feeling he had when Tobias first presented it to him. He was also touched by the proud shout, "What my father brought to me." He finally said, "It doesn't matter about the rifle. I have a pistol in my saddlebag. I hope I don't need a gun, but there's something you maybe can answer for me about this trip. A man at Punta Rasa warned me not to go too far south coming here, that it's outlaw country. Do you know anything about this?" All traces of a smile disappeared quickly as Tawanda said, "Yes, I know. We all know. There are very bad men in the area of the 10,000 Islands. They have sugarcane fields there, and they keep slaves, white men they capture. They keep them in chains and work them like oxen. One of our men was held like this but managed to escape. They also go out and roam the land, stealing cattle and driving them back there. Some they slaughter, and others they take by boat to Key West to be sold. They have killed several of our men and boys who wandered too close while hunting or fishing, and they think no more of killing a man than a snake. I hate to think what has happened to the women they take, too. I have warned Toby to never go that way."
"Could be they're the same ones who attacked us and have stolen our cattle. How many are there?"
"No one knows for sure."
"Well, I'd like to wipe them off the face of the earth, and someday I will."
"Don't be foolish, Zack," Tawanda exclaimed with alarm. "Never go there. If you do, you may not return. My people know that instant death awaits anyone who comes too close to those men. Please, Zack, do not even think of what you have said."
Tawanda's seriousness startled Zack, and he wished he had not asked the question. The possibility of his going into the area was remote, and even so, he wouldn't attempt it without help. He said in a calming voice, "Let's just forget that I even asked Tawanda. I'll go back the same way I came, far to the north of him."
"When do you have to leave?" Tawanda asked, relieved that Zack apparently dismissed the subject from his mind.
"The deed to some land I'm buying will be ready in the morning, and I'd plan to leave as soon as I pick it up. But I'll stay here tonight and tomorrow night so I can spend some time with Toby. One more day won't make any difference in getting back to Punta Rasa."
This pleased Tawanda, and she said, "We will have you then for 2 days. But won't you spend some of the time with me as well as Toby?"
"All that I can," Zack replied. "But what will your people think of our being together again?"
"They will think nothing. They know you are Toby's father. Toby is known as Toby Cypress, but he is also half McIvy, and the name McIvy is respected here. I wouldn't be ashamed if he were called Toby McIvy. So forget what is bothering you about this, and let's make the most of the time we have. Can you do this?"
"I just did. We'll enjoy the next 2 days together. The three of us."
That night, Zack spread his blanket beneath the chicky adjacent to the beds of Tawanda and Toby. It still bothered him to be so open, for he knew such as this would never be accepted or understood in Fort Pierce or Fort Drum or back in the McIvy hammock. It was against all things he had known. When Toby was asleep, Tawanda abandoned her bed and came to him without hesitation. Later on, they both lay awake, and Zack said to her, "Tawanda, there's something I must say to you, and I hope I say it right. I've loved you since that first time I came here with my papa, but I love Glenda, too. I hope it doesn't hurt you for me to tell you this, but it's something you should know. I'll never leave Glenda for you. I remember after I met both you and Glenda, I asked my mama if it's possible for a man to want two women at the same time and love them both. She said yes, but a man must choose between them. I chose Glenda, but it doesn't mean I wanted you less. No matter what happens with us in the future, you and Toby will always be a part of me. It'll pain me less if you know this and accept it.
I accepted it long ago, Zek. The first time we met. I knew you would never be mine. When you chose Glenda, you chose wisely. It could never have been for us to be together except like this. And I knew it from the beginning and accepted it. I am Indian, and you are white. And these are two worlds that have never come together and never will. Had you chosen me, you would have been scorned for it, and you may have come to hate me for it. This way is best for both of us. What part of you I can have is all I expect. You have already given me the one thing I sought since the first time you rode into this village. Your son.
I wish I had known about Toby. There are things I could have done for him during those times he was treated badly by the other boys. It makes me sad to think of it.
Tawanda pushed herself up and said, Zek, never grieve for me or for Toby. We're happy here now. And this is where we belong. We love you and will share whatever we can of you. Whatever part of yourself you give. But don't grieve for us. It would be tears wasted. Think only happy thoughts, not sad ones. This is what we do of you. But enough of this now. We have talked enough. Even an Indian woman likes to do something with her man besides talk.
He said no more as she dropped back down beside him. The next morning, Zek took Toby into the woods and taught him to shoot the Winchester. After this, they took a long ride together, prancing the horses, galloping single file down narrow trails, laughing together when the marsh tackies snorted at each other, each one trying to outperform the other. Toby marveled at Zek's ability with the horse, watching with admiration as Tiger leaped a 5-foot fern without touching even one leaf. When Toby tried the same thing, he brushed the top, but swelled with pride when Zek told him he was as good a rider as he had been at his age. When they returned to the village, Toby took Zek by the hand and led him constantly, going to other boys his age and telling them he could now shoot the Winchester his father brought him, that he knocked an orchid from a cypress limb 50 feet up the tree. He was trying to make up instantly for all those years something was missing from life, all those times he stood by alone and watched enviously as other fathers took their sons hunting or fishing, times when he had no one to follow through the woods with pride. Others had taken him along sometimes, but it was not the same. He was always the outsider, always the one who had only a mother in the Chickie. Now he had a father who could ride like no one else, could outdo even an Indian on a marsh tacky, and could shoot the eye out of a spider with a Winchester. It was a father in visible flesh rather than a phantom nobody believed, and he wanted to make the most of it while he could. The afternoon they all spent together, going deep into the swamp and building a fire beside a small creek. Now it was Toby's time to show Zek how to do something he had never done, and he took the stance of teacher as he slammed the lancewood spear into the side of a bass, repeating it again and again until he had more fish than Tawanda could roast on sticks over the coals. He also caught a snapping turtle and cut out the meat with his new knife, and this Zek liked best of all. Tawanda bubbled with happiness as she watched Zek and Toby enjoying each other, having the two men she loved with her at the same time. If nothing else good ever came her way, this afternoon was enough. Zek spent a few minutes that night visiting with Keith Tiger before he hurried back to the Chickie to spend his remaining time with Tawanda and Toby. Dawn came all too soon, and Zek knew he could stay no longer. After breakfast, he saddled his horse reluctantly, feeling as if he were leaving a part of himself here in the swamp he might never see again. As he started to mount, Tawanda looked to Toby and said, "Now, Toby." The boy stepped forward and said, "I thank you again for the gifts, and, Father, I love you. Will you come and see me again?" Zek couldn't hold back the tears. He took Toby in his arms and said, "Yes, Toby. I will, and I love you, too, very much. Here's one thing I ask of you. Please,
Take care of your mother for me. Will you do this, Toby?
I will look after her as you would if you were here with us. Whatever she asks of me, I'll do.
He could take no more of it. He looked deep into Tawanda's eyes. Then he mounted and rode away quickly. As he made his way back to the trading post, there was no prolonged guilt as there was the last time he had been with Tawanda. He knew now that fate had given him two lives and two families, and he accepted it without question. As Tawanda said to him, the two worlds would never come together. Yet they were there. Rather than comparing Tawanda and Glenda as he often did in the past, he now compared Saul and Toby, finding them alike in many ways. Had they been allowed to grow up together as a pair, they would have been unstoppable, capable of accomplishing anything they desired. But because they were born of different races and cultures, they were destined never to share the same hopes and dreams, or to even know each other. This saddened Zek, and he pondered the why of it. When he reached the trading post and picked up the deed, he didn't purchase even one tin of beef for the return trip. Instead, he put Tiger into a steady canter and headed non-stop for Punta Raza, intending to travel all night if necessary. A rising sun was just streaking the sky as Zek rode the last mile along the Caloosahatchee and approached Punta Raza. He skirted the cabin and went to the store, buying a new Winchester and hoping that no one would notice it was not the same as the one he left with. If they did, he would say he lost his old rifle crossing a river and replaced it at the Okeechobee trading post. Glenda came to him as soon as he rode into the clearing and hitched the horse, and he watched each step she took, reacquainting himself with everything about her, the still, lithe body, the perpetually excited eyes, the red hair yet untouched by any sign of gray. Before she could greet him, he took her in his arms and said, "I love you, Glenda. I really do. And I want you to know it." Then he kissed her.
"Well," she said, putting her arms around him, "if you come back like this each time, I should send you on trips more often. A woman needs to feel she's missed and wanted."
"You've been missed and wanted," he assured her, trying to brush from his mind all that happened during the past few days.
"Did you get what you went after?"
"Yes, I did, and even more than I expected."
"What do you mean?" she asked curiously.
He realized he had almost made a slip in spite of his determination not to. He said, "Even more land than I thought I could buy. It was 15 cents an acre, and the gold I took was enough for 60,000 acres.
"That's a lot of land, isn't it, Zek?"
"Yes, it is. But it's 60,000 acres a Distan can never touch. If we ever have need of it, it's there."
"Are you hungry?"
"I'm about to starve. I didn't eat along the way. How's Papa?"
"He seems fine now. We can leave whenever you say. As soon as you eat and rest, we'll decide what to do."
They walked hand in hand to the cabin, and just as they reached the door, Saul bounded by on the other marsh tacky, galloping full speed. Chapter 32. It was just past noon when the McIvey caravan crossed the Kissimmee below Fort Basinger and turned north. Although Tobias had gained strength and seemed normal, they stopped early each day on the return trip to ensure his rest. The closing days of summer were the hottest of the year, and Emma fretted that the stifling prairie heat would bring back the chills and fever. And there was no need to hurry. The orange crop wouldn't be ready for harvest for 2 or 3 months, and there was little to do until then. They stopped an hour later at the edge of a large hardwood hammock and made camp in the cooling shade of a live oak. All but Tobias and Emma rode away to hunt deer or turkey for the evening meal. Emma built a fire and put the cast-iron pot over the flames, making preparations to cook whatever the evening meal offered. If the hunters failed to bring back wild game, she would make her usual stew of smoked beef and potatoes. There would also be biscuits and an unlimited amount of hot coffee. Frog alone could drink a quart with each meal. Tobias spread a blanket at the base of the tree and fell asleep. Until recently, afternoon napping was as alien to him as the streets of Tallahassee, but now his weakened body urged the extra rest. He would have preferred to follow the others. Emma peeled the potatoes and put them into a bowl and covered it with a cloth to keep out the flies. Then she kneaded the biscuit dough, rolled it on a cypress plank, and patted it into little round mounds. This, too, she covered and set aside, waiting always until the stew or roasted game was done before putting the dough into the Dutch oven for baking. Tobias liked his biscuits fresh from the oven and piping hot, and she always tried to please him. One of her greatest satisfactions was the meals everyone enjoyed with relish. She gave each one as much attention and care as she would a Christmas dinner. After these chores were done, she decided to go into the woods and pick the last of the season's huckleberries for a special treat of pies. This was usually done by Glenda, but on this afternoon Glenda wanted to accompany the men on the hunt. The tiny berries were now fully ripe and deep purple, and most of the bushes had been raided by birds. She picked several bushes clean of all the remaining berries, and they barely covered the bottom of the wooden bucket. Then she moved on to find others. Some she plopped into her mouth and ate, staining her lips with the sweet juice. The sun-blocked darkness of the deep hammock felt good to her, cooling her as she moved constantly, and when she reached the river bank, the berries were 4 inches up the side of the bucket. One more inch, and there would be enough for 4 pies. She turned south and picked along the bank, soothed by the rippling sound coming from the river, enjoying this brief moment of solitude. She loved Tobias and the others, but there were times when she regained her own inner strength by being away from those she loved and served. At such times, the lonely woods became a sanctuary and a cathedral, a place of spiritual resurgence. Time passed swiftly, and finally she realized she must start back to the camp. She had gone but 100 yards from the river when the pain hit her, causing her to stumble and fall to the soft ground. She tried to get up, but could not do so, and then it came again, a searing hot flash that burned into her chest like a branding iron. At first, she was too stunned to realize what was happening to her, and then she knew. Her only thought was that she was going to die alone in the woods without once again seeing Tobias and all the others. Sweat poured from her face, and when she wiped it away with her hand, she discovered that her flesh had no feeling. For several minutes she lay on her back and looked upward into the trees, her eyes focusing on a squirrel that squatted on a limb and barked at her. She finally forced herself to a sitting position, but could not rise further. Her mind was coming and going, aware and then unaware of where she was, one moment resigned to dying alone, and the next moment back at the camp, putting biscuits into the oven, then floating upward into the trees, feather-light, drifting peacefully, wanting to abandon any attempt of survival and become pain-free. Her will to return to Tobias proved stronger, and she struggled to her feet and walked shakily, her view clouded by glazed eyes. She stumbled constantly, falling and then righting herself, stopping often to lean against a tree trunk, step by step making her way by instinct and determination back to the camp. Tobias was awake now, and when she staggered from the woods, he took one look at her and screamed, "Emma! Emma! What in the name of God is wrong with you?" She said feebly, "The pain, Tobias, it hurts so bad. It came on me sudden." Then she wilted and fell to the ground. Tobias ran to the buckboard and snatched up his whip, popping it 3 times, and then he fired both barrels of the shotgun. He rushed back and dropped down beside her, panic-stricken, his heart pounding so wildly it formed a tight ball of spit in his throat. He gagged as he put his hand to her forehead and wiped sweat from her eyes, and then he said, "Oh, God, Emma, Emma, don't you leave me, Emma, you hear me? Don't you leave?" She looked up at him, her eyes momentarily clear. Then her hand went to his, gripping his flesh. She said, "Tobias, Tobias, I'm sorry." Then the last flicker of life went out of her. Tobias shook her, gently at first, and then violently, crying, "Emma, you can't do this! Emma! Emma!" He was not aware when Zek rode in and jumped from the horse, taking one look at the lifeless form and then shouting, "Papa, what has happened? Did someone do something to Mama?" Tobias sat by the body, shocked, speechless, swaying back and forth as he chanted, "Emma, Emma." Zek grabbed his father's shoulder and demanded harshly, "What has happened, Papa? You've got to tell me. Did those goddamn bushwhackers do something to Mama?" Tobias finally looked up and said, "No, Zek. It wasn't that. It was her heart. Or apoplexy, or maybe she was just wore plumb out from this hard kind of life, I don't know. But she's gone from us, Zek. And it ain't fair. It just ain't fair." "Oh, Lord," Zek moaned as he dropped to his knees beside his father. Glenda cooked the potatoes Emma had peeled, knowing the men should eat, but the food was ignored. Zek took Tobias off alone and said to him, "Papa, you want to dig the grave now?" At first Tobias made no answer, as if his thoughts were elsewhere, and he didn't hear the words, and then he said, "We'll not bury Emma out here alone on the prairie. We'll take her back to the hammock where she belongs." "The heat, Papa," Zek said hesitantly. "We're several days from the hammock. The heat..." Tobias suddenly snapped awake and said harshly, "I don't give a damn about the heat. If I have to, I'll shoot every goddamn buzzard along the Kissimmee River. Emma's going home, Zek. We'll not stop till we get there. Do you understand me?" "Yes, Papa. I understand. We'll leave right away and not stop till we reach the hammock." Zek went back and wrapped Emma in a blanket. Then he and Saul placed her in the wagon. Glenda helped Tobias onto the buckboard seat, and as soon as all were mounted, Zek said to Frog, "You and Lester ride on ahead of us and build a coffin. Make it of cypress, not pine, and have it ready time we get there."
"Yes, sir, Mr. Zek,"
Frog responded solemnly, grief-stricken too, his tired eyes dripping sorrow.
"We'll do that, and we'll make it good. It's got to be a fine coffin for Miss Emma."
Zek then popped his whip, moving the oxen and the horses forward. By traveling steadily and as fast as the animals could be pushed, they reached the hammock at nightfall the next day. The coffin was waiting, and Tobias directed it to be placed on chairs in the main room. Glenda removed Emma's clothes and bathed her with damp cloths, and with Zek's help they dressed her in the blue dress she had worn but once at the wedding. After placing her in the coffin, Zek removed the bottle of perfume from Emma's dresser drawer and poured it over the body. Glenda came back into the room and said,
"What is that smell, Zek?" "It's gone all over the house. Peach blossoms. Mama always smelled good to me, and now she does again. It's what she would have wanted."
Tobias took up a vigil at the table, sitting statue-like as he gazed absently across the room, getting up and looking into the coffin and then sitting again. Zek suggested that he sleep while others rotated the vigil throughout the night, but he would have none of it, refusing to leave even for a moment. Zek went to his cabin and lay down, bone-tired. But sleep was beyond even the realm of possibility. He went back to the house and sat by his father in the dim glow of the coal oil lamp. Tobias turned to him and said,
"You know something, Zek. It was your mama who held this family together when times was roughest. Hadn't been for her, you and me would have probably starved. She could cook pine tree roots good enough to keep a man alive. And I never did nothing for her. With all the gold in them trunks, I could have bought her fancy dresses and shoes and such as a woman likes, but all I ever gave her was that goddamn cook stove. And now it's too late to do anything. I waited too long." It bothered Zek that his father was feeling guilt about Emma, and he said, "She didn't want stuff like that, Papa. It wouldn't have meant anything to her. All she wanted was to be with us and help out all she could. And you made her as happy as she could be. She told me that several times when me and her talked. She loved you, Papa. More than anything."
"She told you this?" Tobias questioned. "You really heard her say it?"
"Many times, Papa. Me and her used to talk a lot before I got married. Like a mother and a son.
The kind of talk me and you couldn't do. It's a God's truth, Papa, I swear it.
The words soothed Tobias. Then he said, I'm right beholden to you for telling me now. I was afeard she might have held it against me for keeping her out here in the wilderness. But you listen to me now, Zek, for you have cause to regret it. Don't ever take a woman for granted as nothing more than a cook. A woman gives her man a heap more than biscuits, and he ought to know it. She gives herself. Do something good for Glenda without her asking. Emma would have waited till hell froze over before asking for anything, no matter how much she wanted it. I should have done a lot for Emma, but I didn't. And it wasn't because I didn't love her. I did that, truly. But I put it off and let it slip my mind till now it's too late. Don't make the same mistake, Zek. If you do, it'll pain you more than any varmint can ever hope to do. It pains me now, just as much as that awful thing that struck down Emma, only I'm still here to live with it and she ain't.
I'll heed your words, Papa. But don't you ever worry none about Mama being happy. She was. She was the most happy woman there ever was. Now why don't you go in the bedroom and get some sleep? I'll be right here with Mama.
I'll rest after Emma is at peace in her own ground. Not till then. And maybe not ever. So don't waste your breath by asking me again, Zek. I ain't going to budge from here till the sun comes up. This is the last night I'll ever get to spend with Emma in the house, and I intend to make the most of it. As soon as daylight invaded the hammock, the grave was dug. Glenda greeted the returning men with a hearty breakfast of fried pork, grits, and biscuits, but it seemed eerie to all of them sitting at the table without Emma's bustling smile as she went from table to stove and back again, replenishing plates and waiting until she was sure all were satisfied before sitting down to eat herself. Tobias refused food altogether, taking only coffee as he glanced constantly at the crude coffin resting just 10 feet from the table. It was still impossible for any of them to accept the fact that Emma would never again occupy the chair that now sat empty beside Tobias. Zek wanted to delay no longer and prolong his father's grief, so as soon as they finished eating, he closed the coffin lid and nailed it shut. Ground fog hazed the clearing as they came outside, Zek, Frog, and Lester carrying the coffin with Tobias, Glenda, and Saul following. This was Saul's first encounter with death, and it frightened him, the fear overwhelming sorrow. Tears were mixed with sheer horror as he looked at Emma for the last time before the coffin was closed, seeing his beloved granny lying still and unable to speak or return his glances, knowing in a boy's own way that he would never again feel her warmth and strength as she put her arms around him and whispered, just for the two of them alone, "I love you, Saul." And now, as the procession moved slowly to the grave, he hovered close to Glenda, holding her hand and casting his eyes downward, trying desperately not to break down and cry like a child in front of the others. They put ropes around the coffin and lowered it into the awaiting earth. Then Tobias stepped to the foot of the grave. For a moment he bowed his head in silence, and then he said in broken words, "The good book says, the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. But this time, Lord, you done took back an awful lot. We ain't been no church-going folks like we ought to, but it was because there wasn't no church to go to out here in the wilderness, where you directed us. But, Lord, there ain't never been no finer woman put on earth than Emma. I thank you for the time we spent together. And I wish you had let her stay here with me longer. I'll miss her powerful. And I don't understand why she had to go instead of me. I don't think it's fair, but that's your judgment. But take her to you with the same love she had when she was here. Amen." At this point, Tobias stopped momentarily. Then he spoke again in a tone barely audible to the rest of them, as if the words were meant for Emma alone. "Emma,
I say to you truly, you may be gone in the flesh, but you'll always be right here with me, always. I love you, Emma. And happy sailing.
Zek had never heard his father use the saying before. It surprised him, but he knew the meaning. He echoed, "Happy sailing, Mama."
Tobias threw in the first shovel of dirt. Then he stood by and watched as the grave was filled. Long after the others had gone back to the house, he was still there. He had not changed positions when Zek came back an hour later and placed a bundle on the head of the grave, a large, fragrant bouquet composed of white pond lilies, wild white roses, wild yellow senna, and purple deer tongue.
Chapter 33, 1894. For over a year, Tobias grieved, seldom leaving the clearing and having no interest in cows or anything. After this period of mourning, he gradually focused his attention back on the orange grove, his one personal pride and satisfaction. And he spent most of his time there, often just sitting alone among the trees. Zek often said that Tobias counted each tiny orange as it evolved from a blossom, knowing in advance exactly how many barrels the crop would fill. And this was more fact than jest. Zek, Glenda, and Saul moved into the main house to be closer to Tobias, and Glenda assumed all of the chores that once were Emma's domain, the cooking and washing and house cleaning, never complaining or asking for help. Several times, Zek offered to hire someone to come live on the place and assist her, but each offer was refused. Whenever the men were tending herd close by, she went out each day in the buckboard with a hot meal for them, and often she rode horseback alongside Zek and the others as they drove cows into the corral for branding. Zek could not remember the last time she wore a dress. Seeing her daily in the jeans and chambray shirt and the wide-brimmed black hat. Without the flaming red ponytail hanging down her back, she could have passed for just another cowhand. Zek and the men started fencing the McIvey land, going to Kissimmee and bringing back wagon loads of barbed wire, cutting cypress posts in the swamp, and stringing the unfamiliar barrier yard by yard across the open range, coming back week after week and finding it cut, then stringing again. He knew this would eventually lead to a violent clash, but he was determined to see it through. There had been no drive to Punta Rasa in 2 years, and this was the reason Zek wanted to fence the land. He planned to accumulate herds, abandon the practice of wandering with them all summer, and fatten them on McIvey land before driving them to market. And there was no way to contain the cattle except with the hated wire. They were still plagued constantly by rustlers, often finding cows slaughtered on the range or driven away. During the previous summer, they took turns riding armed guard both day and night. But it did no more good than looking for invisible sandflies. The raiders were indeed ghosts, killing and stealing and then vanishing. Only now, Zek felt sure he knew where they were coming from. His thoughts turned more and more to the 10,000 Islands area and what Tawanda said about the outlaws there. There were many times when Zek thought of Tawanda and Toby, wondering about them, regretting that he could not see Toby grow into early manhood as Saul was doing. He surmised that Toby was beginning to take his place among the men of the tribe and fulfill the prophecy of leadership. But no matter how much he yearned to see them, there had been no reason or opportunity for him to return to the Indian village. And even if there had been a reason during this past 2 years, he dared not leave Tobias alone for an extended period of time. His health was becoming more and more fragile. Zek also remembered the things Tobias said to him the night before Emma's burial. And each time he went into Kissimmee or Fort Drum or Fort Pierce, he brought back gifts for Glenda, dresses still hanging unused in her closet, ribbons and bottles of perfume, aprons with lace borders, silk underthings it took all his courage to buy, all of them useless on a wilderness homestead, but nevertheless appreciated by Glenda. His mother's death and Glenda's willing assumption of Emma's role brought them even closer together, forming an unbreakable bond between them. December 28th.
Papa, come down off there before you sail away like a kite. The wind's too strong for us to pick any longer.
Tobias paid no heed to Zek as he continued to perch on top of a wooden ladder leaning against an orange tree, a canvas sack slung over his shoulder. Zek shouted again,
"Damn it, Papa, come on down before I come after you."
"I'll finish the sack first," Tobias shot back.
"Go on about your business and let me be."
"Stubborn old billy goat," Zek mumbled as he walked away and started loading filled barrels onto the ox wagon. Glenda's special Christmas dinner, with roasted turkey and minced meat pies, was still fresh on everyone's mind as they put the holiday behind them and worked the grove. There was a bumper crop of juice-filled globes, and the harvest was about a third finished. The wind started early that morning, and the sky far in the north was totally black, signifying a coming northern. This was the time of year when brief storms and cold fronts rushed across the land and then disappeared as quickly as they arrived, making the temperature go up and down rapidly, often changing as much as 30 degrees in 1 hour. It was not a thing of dread, but something to look forward to, not only for its temporary cooling effect, but also because it sweetened the winter crop of collards now full-grown in the garden and made the oranges even juicier. Everyone else went back to the house as Zek waited for his father to finish picking and empty his sack into a barrel. As soon as this was done, he drove the oxen to the barn and stored the barrels inside the adjacent orange shed. By mid-afternoon, the wind took on more authority and roared instead of growling. It lashed the hickory and oaks and popped the palmetto as the temperature dropped sharply, causing Zek to shiver as he left the house and went to the small corral attached to the rear of the barn. Frog and Lester were already there, driving the horses and oxen inside, where they would be given a feeding of hay and bedded down for the night. Frog pulled the lightweight denim jacket tighter around his neck and said,
"Feels like the devil's stinging me. This storm gonna be a humdinger if it gets much colder. I think I'll build a big fire in my cabin and bring out a jug of rum. That ought to keep an old man like me warm."
"I guess it would," Zek said. "But before you do that, we need to chop more firewood, and what we need is firewood, Frog, not firewater."
"Every man to his own choice," Frog smiled. "And you ain't even near about as old and wore out as me. Young man don't need extra fuel like an old man does, especially when it gets cold in winter."
By the time Zek got back to the stoop, the outside thermometer attached to the wall showed only 3 degrees above freezing. He brought an armload of stove wood into the kitchen and returned for another, and in this short time the mercury had dropped to 31 degrees. Tobias was sitting close to the stove when Zek brought in the last load of wood.
"How's it doing out there?" he asked.
"Getting colder, Papa. It just went to a degree below freezing."
"If it keeps this up and holds for long, it'll sure play hell with the oranges. I wish we'd got done with the picking before this came."
"It'll probably ease up and pass by. It always has. If the wind keeps up like this, it'll blow the cold over the tops of the trees anyway. There's no need for worry."
"Maybe so," Tobias said doubtfully. "But if the temperature drops much more, everybody better pray it don't rain. If it does, we'll have the damnedest ice storm you ever seen. I've seen it happen a many a time in Georgia when I was a boy, and it always started out just like this."
"Well, it didn't really hurt nothing, did it, Papa?"
"Not so much that nature didn't cure in the spring, but we sure didn't have orange trees up there." At supper time, the kitchen was cozy warm, and the meal took on a festive air. After a sweltering summer and the sultry dog days of early fall, a cold snap was a welcome relief. It thickened the blood and invigorated everyone to a point of exhilaration. No one except Tobias seemed to be particularly concerned as the wind pounded the side of the house and rattled the cypress shingles. Frog helped himself to a second portion of collard greens and corn pone and said,
"If it's still cold in the morning, we ought to go out and shoot wild hogs. There ain't no better time for the killing and dressing of hogs. It makes the meat taste sweet as honey."
"That's not a bad idea," Zek agreed. "We could cook some fresh, smoke some, and salt down the rest. We might could get enough pork to last all winter."
"Can I go too, Papa?"
Saul asked, excited by just the mention of a hunt.
There's time you can. If you're not old enough now to face a wild boar, you never will be. Way before I was your age, I'd done killed a bear with Papa's old shotgun.
That's for sure, Tobias said. Zek done it when we lived up in the scrub. Two bears tried to get in the barn one night when I was off driving Confederate cattle up to Georgia during the war. When they hemmed your granny up, Zek blowed one of them bears slam across the clearing and into the woodshed.
Saul's eyes widened, and he said, Really, Grampy? Did Papa really do that? You're not funning me again, are you?
He sure enough did.
Will you tell me about it sometime, please, Grampy? Will you?
I'll tell you about it when we ain't got nothing better to do, so just hush up about it now. And I'll tell you a lot more besides that. We've seen some things and done some things folks nowadays wouldn't believe.
Would you believe your big, brave daddy tripping over his own boots and falling flat on his face at a square dance? Glenda said to Saul. Did you do that, Papa?
Can't say as I did, Zek laughed. Leastwise, I don't remember. But your mama once ate some rattlesnake meat and threw up all over the prairie.
That's enough, Glenda snapped. Not at mealtime, anyway. We started out talking about hog hunting, so how do we get around to all this?
Well, Miss Glenda, Frog said, when you get a bunch of dodo birds perched on the same fence, like they is in here now, there ain't no telling which way the conversation'll go. But getting back to hogs, are we going in the morning or not? If we ain't, I won't come out at sunup and freeze my tail off for nothing.
We'll go, Zek said. Come first dawn, we'll eat and leave.
Not me, Tobias said. My days of chasing some scrawny varmint all over the woods is long gone.
I'll stay here and help later with the scraping, if you get anything to scrape.
Fair enough, Zek said, relieved that Tobias did not want to go. We'll meet here in the kitchen at dawn.
Before going to bed, Zek stoked the fire to keep the room warm during the night. Then he took the coal oil lamp and went out to the stoop. The wind made the flame flicker and nearly go out as he held the lamp in front of the thermometer. It now read 20 degrees, a temperature drop of 55 degrees since morning. And for the first time, he shared Tobias's concern. But he learned long ago they were all powerless and at the mercy of their most fickle and deadly adversary, the weather. It couldn't be shot or hanged or roped or corralled or harnessed in any way. It rendered them helpless against all onslaughts. And whatever was to come would come, regardless of worry or concern. He glanced once more, and then he turned and went back into the house. Dawn was late in coming because the sun couldn't penetrate a low covering of black clouds boiling just over the treetops. There was an eerie gray gloom permeating the clearing when Zek came outside and looked anxiously at the thermometer. It read 14 degrees, and the cold slapped into his face like ice water. He shivered violently and went back into the house. He went to the stove and backed up as close as he could get to it, shivering again, feeling the heat tingle his flesh as it drove away the cold. Glenda put on the coffee pot and said,
What's the reading now?
14 degrees. The water bucket is froze solid. If it wasn't for the wind still blowing, we'd be knee-deep in frost. I've never seen it so cold.
Are you still going hunting?
I guess. It's up to the others. If they want to, I will, but we'll all have to wear 2 pairs of breeches.
It's foolish to go out in this. You'll make yourselves sick.
Well, if we do go, I don't think we'll have to shoot any hogs. They'll be so froze we can pick 'em up like cordwood and bring 'em on back to the house.
Tobias came into the room and poured himself a mug of coffee. He said,
I heard what you said, Zek. 14 degrees. That means the oranges are gone. And if it holds for much longer, the trees will go too.
Zek knew the truth of this, but still he didn't want Tobias upset. He said,
Don't count them out yet, Papa. This may blow over by noon. If it does, I don't think it'll leave much damage.
If you believe that, you also believe a jaybird can play a fiddle.
There was nothing more Zek could say, and he was relieved when Frog and Lester came into the house and interrupted the conversation. Frog backed up to the stove and said,
Lord have mercy, what a feeling it is to drape your bare bottom over one of them outhouse holes on a morning like this. I think my butt is froze solid. It's probably going to crack when it thaws.
It's already cracked, Zek chuckled. Frog rubbed himself vigorously.
It may be, but I'm going to have more than one crack time this is over. Next time I take a crap, I'll have to spread myself over two seats.
Glenda smiled and shook her head as she continued the task of making fried hoe cakes for their breakfast. She mumbled, "You men." After the meal was finished, they took the rifles and went to the barn to saddle the horses. The cold rushed through the double layers of clothing like they weren't there, burning the skin and making the bones feel like they were being crushed. If any one of them had backed out, the others would follow gladly, but no one made the suggestion, each waiting to see what the others would do. Zek said, "Any hog with good sense is going to be buried as deep as he can get in some bushes. I don't think we'll have much luck without dogs unless we riot them out ourselves."
"Well, I ain't going to stick my foot in no damn bushes for sure," Frog said. "There'll be rattlers in there, too. Maybe we ought to just ride for a spell and see what it looks like, if the horses don't freeze under us."
"Me and Sol'll go down by the garden and cut north. You and Lester go west. If you need help, pop your whip."
"It may be too froze to pop," Frog responded. "And if I'm stuck to the saddle when we get back, I'll just ride my horse into the kitchen."
The horses blew white clouds of icy breath as they trotted away. When Zek and Sol reached the garden, they paused and looked over the split-rail fence. All of the plants were flat on the ground and had taken on the death color of yellow. Only a few hardy collards were still upright, but the fringes of each leaf were curling. Tomatoes, beans, squash, and peppers lay in lifeless heaps. They turned north and rode into the grove. Zek dismounted, picked an orange, and cut it in half with his hunting knife. The inside was solid ice, and when he squeezed it, a blob of frozen juice plopped to the ground and bounced like a steel ball. He knew now the remaining crop was a total loss, and he dreaded telling Tobias. From the grove, they went into the creek bottom and found a flight of 20 Carolina parakeets dead on the ground, all frozen. One remaining bird was on a tree limb, swaying drunkenly. As they watched, it fluttered to the ground, flapping its wings in one last desperate gasp of life, and then it too lay still. The sight of the colorful bodies dotting the ground in motionless heaps saddened Sol. He said, "Papa, are they all going to die?"
"I suppose so. They can't stand this much cold. It'll kill a lot of fish, too, and other things."
Sol then said, "Papa, I'm not trying to back out of the hunt if you want to keep going, but every time my hand touches metal, it sticks to it. It feels like it's going to pull my skin off. I don't think I can hold my rifle and aim it without some gloves."
"I'm having the same trouble. We best go on back to the house now. There's no need for us to stay out here and freeze for nothing."
Shortly after they reached the house, Frog and Lester returned too. The rest of the day was spent in the room by the stove. The cold lingered on for 2 days as they all huddled inside for warmth. A clear sky and brilliant sun greeted the third morning, and the temperature rose rapidly to 75 degrees. Tobias and Zek went to the grove and found the trees not green but brown, each already surrounded by piles of fallen dead leaves. Tobias cut into the trunk of one and said, "It ain't dead all the way. They just might make it if it stays warm like this. I just thank the Lord we didn't get no rain and ice with all that cold."
"They'll make it, Papa. We may never have another cold snap that bad. What I need to do now is replant the garden. There's not a single thing left in there alive. And I sure don't want to go back to eating wild poke 2 meals a day."
"Poke ain't so bad. We lived off it for years when we had to."
"I know, Papa. But tomatoes and beans and collards is better. As soon as we get back to the house, I'll put out the seeds."
A month later, Tobias came running through the woods, shouting as loud as he could, "They done it! They done it!" Everyone poured out of cabins and house, and Zek scrambled from the barn and raced to meet his father as he came into the clearing. He said,
"What in the world is all the shouting for, Papa?"
"The orange trees," Tobias panted. "They're putting out sap and new growth. They're going to bloom, Zek. They done made it."
"That's great, Papa, just great. I knew they'd come through."
"I sure thought for a while it was all gone, but the Lord's done smiled down on us. I gotta go now and tell Emma." Zek stood by Glenda, and put his arm around her as they watched the frail body lumber across the clearing toward the small plot of ground bearing the grave. February 6, 1895. Zek was in the garden, driving thin stakes into the ground beside the tomato and bean plants that were thrusting up from the soft soil, when he felt the first rush of cool air. It was a moist breeze, not hot and dry, and he said to Saul, who was working close by, "Gonna rain soon. It'll be good for the garden. We better hurry and get done with this." A thunderhead formed in the north, layer upon layer of black clouds that spread rapidly and soon covered the horizon. The wind then came in gusts, blowing leaves from the nearby woods and scurrying them across the garden. Rain was just beginning to pelt down when they reached the clearing and ran for the stoop. Zek stood there for several minutes, watching the blue sky disappear as clouds raced to the south like galloping horses, turning early afternoon into twilight. The rain came steadily all afternoon, pattering against the cypress roof, and when Zek finally left the house and ran for the barn to tend the livestock, there was a strange coolness in the air and the rain. It felt like little drops of ice, rather than water. Shortly after dark, the wind increased to a howling fury, rattling the windows and making the walls creak. The temperature dropped rapidly, and they put more wood into the stove to warm the room. Tobias paced back and forth. His face creased with worry. He said to Zek, "I don't like the sound or the feel of this. It's more than a rainstorm for sure."
"Don't go seeing buggers in every cloud," Zek said. "You're just gun-shy, Papa. There's just no way we're going to have another storm like that last one. It'll pass over before the sun comes up."
"Don't never say no way," Tobias admonished. "Whatever the Lord wants to do, he'll do, and he's not going to ask our advice about it." The wind didn't abate, and Zek could hear it continue pounding throughout the night. When he crawled from beneath the warm quilts at dawn, he was greeted by a room as cold as an ice cavern. He dressed hurriedly and rushed outside, and what he saw stunned him. The temperature was at 11 degrees, and what had been rain the day before was now sleet. Every tree was ice-covered, and the ground was one solid sheet of ice. Zek and Saul brought in as much wood as they could pile in the kitchen, and the frozen wood made loud hissing sounds as it was put into the fire. At mid-morning, the sleet stopped, and an hour later snow came, a blinding, swirling blizzard that erased the earth and turned the clearing and the woods into a sea of white. Saul was fascinated, seeing such a phenomenon for the first time, not realizing it was also the first glimpse of snow for all except Tobias, and he had not seen it now since leaving Georgia almost 40 years ago. Tobias again paced the room. He went to a window and looked out, grimacing as the flakes hit the ground and froze immediately, piling deeper and deeper. He turned to all the others in the room and said, "The Lord's done treat us for sure this time, like a wild cat with no place left to go but down and the ground full of dogs. There ain't nothing what can survive this. It's all gone now." Zek did not even try to console Tobias this time, knowing full well his father spoke the truth. Nothing would survive, not even some of the small animals with a covering of fur. As the day wore on, the air was filled with cracking sounds that came like thunder as overburdened tree limbs gave way from the weight of ice and crashed to the ground. In late afternoon, Zek and Frog fought their way to the barn to feed the horses and oxen, and Zek could see that the woods were becoming impassable from cluttered limbs. There were great raw gashes on trees where limbs had broken away. They had been caught by surprise, without an adequate supply of chopped wood, and in order to conserve what they had, Frog and Lester abandoned their cabins and came into the house, sleeping that night on blankets spread on the kitchen floor. The next morning the snow still came, not a blinding blizzard as the day before, but a steady falling of white flakes. At noon, it stopped and was replaced by sleet once more, frozen rain that formed a hard crust over the 7 inches of powdery snow. The thermometer rose only 1 degree to 12 and hovered there. There was no festive mood in the house this time, no joviality as the grim-faced captives looked out windows at the ice-encased earth, wondering when and if it would ever stop. It was an almost impossible challenge to slide and stumble to the barn and give each animal a short ration of hay. The outside pile of the precious fodder was now a frozen mass rendered useless. Tobias went out to the stoop constantly, looking anxiously at the thermometer and coming back inside, repeating the cycle again and again, until finally Zek warned him that all he was accomplishing was turning cold air into the house, icy gusts that did not dissipate without adding more wood to the fire. Just before nightfall, Zek and Frog and Lester went into the yard and brought in more wood, almost exhausting the supply, each dreading the possibility they might have to go into the woods and chop a fresh supply from the ice. Tobias insisted that he help, and in spite of Zek's protests, he brought several loads to the stoop, turning his thin hands blood red and making them sting like fire. It was when Glenda put supper on the table that Tobias was first missed. All of them paid no heed to his absence from the kitchen, thinking he had gone into his bedroom to rest after helping with the wood. Zek went for Tobias and found the room empty. He came back into the kitchen and said anxiously, "Papa's not in there. Did anyone see him come back in the house after the last load of wood?"
"I wasn't paying any mind to him, Zek," Glenda said, becoming frightened too. "I saw him after that," Sol said. "He was putting some pine kindling into his coat pockets, but I didn't see him no more."
"Oh, my lord," Zek moaned. "He slipped out and headed for the grove. I'll go after him."
"I'll go with you, Papa," Sol said, scrambling for his jacket.
"No, there's no use for but one of us to freeze. I'll see to it myself. The rest of you stay here."
Zek went down the stoop and paused for a moment, letting his eyes adjust to the darkness, then looking ahead at the ghostly forms of ice-covered trees. He made his way forward one cautious step at a time, sliding over the hard crust, entering the woods and moving gingerly through a jungle of shattered limbs, hoping that no more of them would come crashing down and land on top of him. When finally he reached the outside edge, he could see it ahead of him, a fire, glowing like a beacon, giving him direction to the edge of the grove. Tobias was standing there, trying to warm himself as smoke and flames leaped upward into the shriveled tree, his frozen beard glistening with ice. Zek emerged from the darkness and said harshly, "Papa, what the hell you mean coming out here? It'll be the death of you." Tobias turned to him and said calmly, "I had to come here, Zek. I've got to save at least one tree, and heat from a fire is the only way. If I don't save one tree, there won't be nothing left to take guttons from and start the grove again. I've got to save one tree."
"Damn them trees, Papa. After this is over, we can grow another tree somehow, but we can't grow another you. Come on now, let's go back to the house before we both turn into chunks of ice."
"I'll not leave here and let the fire go out," Tobias said defiantly.
"Don't you understand what I'm doing, Zek? There won't be one tree left standing nowhere, not here or anywhere.
Can't you understand? I'll not..."
The fire went out of his eyes, and the words stopped as his lanky body suddenly folded and toppled backward into the small circle of slush caused by the heat of the crackling pine.
"Oh, Papa! Papa!"
Zek said as he picked him up, surprised by how light the frail form was. Then he went back into the darkness, groping his way as quickly as he could toward the clearing. Tobias's flushed face poured sweat as they put him into the bed and covered him with quilts. He came awake and said,
"You got to promise me something, Zek. You'll replant the trees. Oranges is the best way to go, better than cows. Don't have to chase them. You got to promise."
"I promise, Papa. Just be quiet and get some rest. We'll talk about it later."
He drifted away again as Glenda put her hand to his forehead and said,
"He's burning up with fever. I'm afraid he's got pneumonia as well as a malaria spell. He's real sick, Zek. Real sick."
"I know. I know it, Glenda. He may not even last out the night. If I'd known he'd do something foolish like this, I would have nailed the door shut. You'd think them trees are the only things on earth that count."
"Maybe they really do mean that much to him."
"Maybe so, but they're not worth this. It's just that when an old man gets something on his mind, there's no way to make him let go of it. No way.
but he sure did what he thought he had to do. You can't fault him for that.
Zek and Glenda both sat with him throughout the night, Glenda bathing his face with damp cloths, trying vainly to bring the fever down, Zek just sitting and staring, feeling helpless and useless.